Welcome to Behind the Biology, brought to you by ATCC. I'm your host, Dave Yarmusch. In this series, we're speaking to Professor Jamie Krill of Syracuse University about his experience in the field of forensic microbiology. Join us as we engage in discussion about how to use microorganisms to determine if a crime was a biological one, or if these microbes can clarify when and where a person has been recently, what the current methods are for such determination, and what it's like to teach these skills to graduate students. Professor Krill, thank you for coming on. I really appreciate the time you're spending with us.
Thank you for having me. Wonderful opportunity.
Your official title, I believe, is Professor of Practice. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I can't say that's a term I'm terribly familiar with.
Sure. Professor of Practice here at Syracuse University, really what it means is that I have a lot of real-world experience that I'm bringing to the table. So the situation that I'm currently in is that I've spent probably the last 12 to 15 years working in the field of microbial forensics, and I do not have a PhD. So when I decided to get into academics, it's kind of a tough sell. You don't have a PhD, but meanwhile, your students are working on PhDs. You've got master's students, you have undergrads, but they didn't want to dismiss the years of experience, especially in an area that's really important. So they allow several people this kind of opportunity to teach based on the experience that they have.
Speaking of a great opportunity, that sure sounds like one. So tell me a little more about, the combination of being a professor, and you're a research professor, right?
Yeah.
So tell me a little about your project. What are you actively working on right now?
So the research that I focus on mainly has to do with microbial forensics, which, you know, to quote or paraphrase Dr. Bruce Bedoli, is a scientific discipline that's dedicated to analyzing evidence from a bioterrorist act, biocrime, organism release, inadvertent or on purpose, for attribution purposes. So the key to a lot of my research has to do with that attribution. Where do things come from? And based on my experience, the main focus is, you know, bacteria, yeast, a lot of high throughput genomic sequencing, some bioinformatics, as much as I hate to get into the computer science, it's a necessary evil now.
They say all roads end there.
Yeah, they do.
If you're able to say, can you describe what types of microbes that you look for? I mean, you said bacteria and yeast, but what specific ones, and what would they indicate, especially from an attribution standpoint?
Sure. Some of the organisms, a couple of the main organisms that I work with in my lab and my students work with, the first one is Bacillus subtilis, right? So I'm at a university and don't really want to bring anthrax into the lab, right? So it's a good surrogate to do some of these initial studies with. One of the projects I'm working on now is single cell isolation of Bacillus subtilis spores from complex matrices, such as environmental samples like dust and soil and things that have a lot of other organisms in it. But we're very interested in one organism in particular.
Almost in my terms, I would say like a single cell extraction from a metagenome.
Yes, exactly.
Or at least a metagenomic matrix.
Exactly. And you mentioned the metagenome, and that's, you know, kind of a double-edged sword, right? You can get a lot of information from all the other organisms that might be present in a sample. You know, if you imagine a scenario where there was a biocrime or a bioterrorist act, and you really need to investigate environmental samples to determine what was released, you know, where did it come from? That where did it come from? The attribution might not come directly from the organism itself, but all the organisms around it. You know, being able to tell the difference, is this an organism that occurs naturally, or is this actually something that was distributed with intent?
In this case in particular, to speak to Bacillus subtilis, that is fairly universal in soils, is it not?
It is, yes.
Right, so I would imagine then that any attribution comes either from a strain typing of the bacillus or from the surrounding organisms like you mentioned.
Right. So strain typing, and I'm sure this is something you've kind of encountered too in metagenomics, can be incredibly difficult because you have a lot of other information that you're trying to weed through. So being able to isolate single cells and interrogate them separately is useful. It's kind of a front end approach on the what we might call, quote unquote, the metagenomics problem, right?
Yeah, I see how that would work if, especially if you're talking from a high throughput sequencing perspective, you just don't have as much information if you're doing a full metagenomics, but looking for one organism.
Right, right. The resolution's lost in everything else.
Right, exactly. It's almost a single signal-to-noise ratio problem, so common in science. Out of, you know, my own personal curiosity, the Bacillus genus as a whole, especially the Bacillus cereus group, is particularly complicated in that the anthrax toxins are mobile, right? They're mobile genetic elements on plasmids. Is that a factor in your work right now?
You know, not right now. I think because right now what we're doing is so so new, especially to our lab, we haven't really gotten into much more other than can we get a really high resolution detection strain typing of the organism that we've selected. So single cell amplification, there's a lot of really great kits out there, there's some really great papers, but it's pretty technique heavy. So getting students up to the point to where they're you know, sequencing in the lab, it takes a little bit of time. It takes a little bit of time. So we're almost there.
So that's interesting. Are these students, I imagine this isn't part of the standard coursework, especially for the undergrad and maybe even the master's level. Is this like a major research focus for either of the graduate sets? In, I don't know, I guess their allocated laboratory time, is that what they're focusing on? Is this ability, this knowledge to establish the ability then for the single cell amplification?
Yeah, you know, that's part of it. Our master's program in forensics is, there's a track that requires some sort of laboratory research experience, and that can go from a semester or during the whole 2 years that you're working on your master's. So the students that I get from the master's program really try to dedicate at least a year of their time in my laboratory or other laboratories on campus. So the focus of their project has to be something forensics related, right?
Right.
So the tools that we teach them on, the instrumentation, you know, all of that, very standard in what you would find in a typical forensics lab. Some of the techniques, we get into some very technical, heavy, hands-on type of research, right? A lot of field scientists want to come in. And I really think that the research in my lab helps develop those skills so that when they've graduated, they can, you know, apply to some of these positions and actually have a good skill set, some of the general knowledge and maybe even a little bit of expertise in a particular area.
Right. Set them up to succeed in a potentially less forgiving environment than academia.
Right.
And speaking of success, how does that present to you? How do you measure success in let's say with the example of a Bacillus subtilis single cell amplification from a soil matrix. I don't know what that looks like. I've only been on the bioinformatics side of this.
You know, success as far as getting the single cell isolated really comes in the back end of that. So the instrument that I'm using is called the DEP array. It's actually was designed for isolating circulating tumor cells. And it's found its way into forensics research, being able to isolate and separate multiple cell contributors, right? Human cells and sperm cells and things like that. So when I got onto campus, we had one in one of my colleagues' labs, Dr. Michael Marciano. And I thought, you know, wow, this would be kind of cool to isolate bacteria because it's got some unique features. You know, there's a microscopy component and you can actually see the cells moving towards the tube that you want to drop it in. So there's a level of confidence, right, that you're getting what it is you want. You can look at the morphology, you can use different kinds of staining techniques. So the success is kind of measured in a few different ways. What we've been able to do is take some Bacillus subtilis that's been spiked into a soil matrix, which carries potentially hundreds to thousands of different kinds of bacteria and yeast, and use an antibody that's labeled with a fluorophore to specifically target those spore cells. And you can actually watch them flow through into your tube, right? So we take that tube, there's one level of success, right? We've seen it. We think that we have, you know, labeled the organism that we want. Now we want to make sure.
Right, and you got a good idea of what a Bacillus cell looks like and you've watched that shape fall into the cell, into the tubes.
Right. And we want to keep in mind that, you know, there could be a lot of other cells there that look like Bacillus. So we've got that antibody that specifically targets the spores. But you want to increase your confidence all the way down through the bioinformatics. So when we were able to isolate some spores, we did single cell amplification and were able to sequence on our MinION in-house, and it was fantastic. So the first couple runs, we've had some real success here. So now we really want to challenge the system and, you know, test it with, make sure that we're getting a lot of different spores that have the similar kind of morphology, that we're identifying them correctly with the bioinformatics. You know, so success, you know, it builds up to ultimately at the end, do we have what we think we have?
Right. If you pass test A, test B, test C, you're increasingly confident and you can move forward.
Right.
So I know you weren't always a professor. Is there like an internal satisfaction for passing on the experience and the knowledge you have and watching your students pick it up and learn and develop on their own?
Absolutely. You know, before getting into academics, I was thinking, you know, geez, I just want to work in the lab, right? I want to be hands-on. I want to be looking at the data and the teaching and the education part. Well, that's just, you know, it's really not. I get so much out of it. One of the students that I had recently that just graduated took a job at one of my previous employers doing exactly what I was doing, you know, when I first started there, you know, some 10 years ago. So I thought it was really, really cool to see that, you know, we're teaching the right things, we're setting students up for success, you know, and they're able to go out there and really hit the ground running using what they've learned.
Yeah, that sounds like a particularly great full circle kind of example. I can't help myself, so I want to circle back to the identification on the bioinformatics side of things. And what do you look for bioinformatically to determine Bacillus subtilis from any of the other Bacillaceae?
Well, for strain identification, right, there's some really good ways to do this, but in particular, we want to look for specific genes of interest, right? Specific mm-hmm. genes that are going to identify a strain from another strain that kind of separate the two. And even in some of my other projects, especially with yeast, which is becoming more and more difficult, the more and more I work with yeast, it's really my first time. The database issues that we're facing, which is incomplete or mm-hmm. inconsistent databasing, right? So you can have in like your RefSeq or in NCBI, the whole genome, right, of an organism. You might even have a few different strains available, but you don't really have that authentication, right? And one of the other problems I'm facing now is that a lot of the strains that I'm interested in looking at are just not assembled well, right? They were submitted a long time ago using a lot of different techniques. They really don't pass the muster that they should now. Mm-hmm. So when you're creating a database on the bioinformatics end, it's your output's only as good as the database that you're comparing it to. Right. So if your database is a little bit bunk, then you're biased in some way, that's exactly what you're going to get out of the other end.
I imagine for this organism in particular, that's maybe more complicated because while it's related to the Anthracis biothreat agent, it itself is just a common soil bacterium that's probably found in other media as well and doesn't really spur people to sequence it and assemble it on a large volume, right? Like I can't imagine there are so many grants out there for let's get dirt from as many places as we can, isolate the Bacillus subtilis, assemble it, submit it for public knowledge. You know, it's just not as concerning of an organism as, you know, you look at COVID in the recent example, SARS-CoV-2, there's literally millions of completely assembled genomes of it. Yeah. Granted, it's also not a spore-forming bacterium, so it's a little easier, but...
Yeah, I would say that, you know, Bacillus subtilis is fairly well-characterized. One of the yeast that I'm working with, Yarrowia lipolytica, this is another globally distributed organism. Actually, this is a project that I'm working with, I've actually partnered with ATCC for. You guys happen to have about 120 different strains. Mm-hmm. So there's about 26 strains-ish available in NCBI's database. And what we're seeing is the assemblies aren't great. The metadata is not there. We don't know where it came from. But the strains that I can get from ATCC are authenticated. ATCC knows who deposited these strains, knows where they were isolated from. I can go back to these strains over and over again and get the same thing. So this, you know, sample provenance, I think one of your earlier guests discussed, Dr. Jonathan Jacobs, is incredibly important and something I'm really trying to work out. So Yarrowia lipolytica might not be terribly interesting in the way of forensics research, but because it's locally distributed and found everywhere, there's a lot of strains out there. I think it would be really interesting to be able to tell based on strains, can we identify if something's been moved from one place in the world to another based on the strains of Yarrowia lipolytica that are there? You know, it's part of our microbiome. It's one of the indicator species for the postmortem interval. I think it's a good way to go. Plus, it's an interesting organism that it degrades a lot of different kinds of hydrocarbons. It just has a lot of utility to it. So adding to that, you know, that depth of knowledge of that organism, I think is a good spin right now.
I'm strongly inclined to agree. Yeasts are fairly poorly represented in most genomics databases as a general rule. If it's not Saccharomyces, it's not being studied. There's a handful of exceptions, of course. Even from an attribution perspective, you want to know as much information as you can about, say, a biocrime, as you've said. if you can find, you know, what you're looking for, if you can find evidence that this Uralia lipolitica is sourced from three states over, four countries over, two continents over, what have you, well, that'll raise a red flag, right? That'll be a significant piece of evidence. And along the same lines, if the materials or the database, either way that you're comparing to, isn't completely authenticated, it doesn't have that complete chain of custody, essentially, and the complete documentation, well, the red flag piece of evidence you have isn't quite as red anymore. Because right. maybe that Uralia lipolitica, which claims to be from, say, the UK, is, you know, it came from Germany through the UK, or, you know, any other possibility in this chain of custody.
Right. And I would say, too, the importance of it, of your confidence in your database can't be overstated, because in forensics and diagnostics, there's real world consequences to getting it wrong. So, yeah, it's definitely worth a study.
Right. I know we typically think from the clinical perspective, be it, you know, clinical diagnostics or treatment or anything else along those lines, that there are real world consequences. But once you start talking biocrimes or bioterrorist event, we're looking at legal proceedings, and the confidence required to push forward is all the same. I mean, the consequences are comparably dire, at least.
Right, right. And being able to convince, you know, scientists is one thing, that the science is sound, but being able to convince a jury might be a complete other story.
That's going to wrap the first episode in our three-part series with Professor Krill. Next week, we'll get into some more detail on what he did before becoming professor, and how it set him up to be in a somewhat uncommon position without a doctorate.